All right, let's just give us a sync. Sweet. All right, cool. We're here with Christina this time. How you guys doing?
Doing good.
Do you want to kick it off by telling us who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I'm Christina. I am a second year PhD student in political theory department of Doctoral School of Political Science here at CU. And I am working generally in democratic theory, but also in social equality. I focus on various puzzles within democratic theory literature, such as the puzzle of representation, the political equality as the fundamental value, how democracy is necessary for social equality, what social equality then is, and what can undermine it or ensure it. So basically that is what I work on. Also populism. I'm very interested in theories of populism.
Oh, cool. Do you want to start us off with your thoughts on democracy in general?
Mm-hmm. So democracy for me has as its fundamental value, as the value that is most central to it, political equality. And of course, this is arguable. Not everyone agrees. For some other scholars of democracy, autonomy, personal autonomy, is the value that is really fundamental because democracy is said to instantiate personal autonomy or collective autonomy. And I disagree with that because I think that personal autonomy is sometimes incompatible with the democratic outcome that we get in the end. So I think that political equality or procedure that really realizes this equality is more fundamental. And when I say political equality, what I mean is equal political power. And by equal political power, I understand equal opportunity to influence the outcomes of democratic decision making. That means pre-voting deliberation, that everyone can have equal opportunity to deliberate, that everyone's judgment is equally heard, and that everyone's judgment is given equal respect. What I mean by that is that everyone's judgment has equal status in terms of reason giving. So I will take your judgment and your judgment is equally reason giving to me, absent some special circumstances such as that you're obviously discriminatory towards someone or maybe you're biased or under the influence of substances or stuff like that. But as long as I give your judgments equal reason giving status, then I can say that, yes, I have respected your political power and our political power is equal. No one has higher influence here.
Yeah, I think that brings up already a couple of things. One is the distinction of autonomy versus equality, mm-hmm. right? Which is brings up the question of why do we even build societies? To me, at least, that takes mm-hmm. it immediately there of, are we engaging in society or are we trying to build something to ensure that every individual has greater autonomy and that like we reduce the mm-hmm. struggle they have to meet personal needs? Or is it that we're engaging in a organized social structure mm-hmm. that can benefit the lives of everybody there. Mm-hmm. And that does seem to be one of the core divisions between a more, say, liberal versus conservative or even more progressive and conservative. I think maybe even mm-hmm. liberals and conservatives might agree on the autonomy
right.
point.
Right.
But where does that leave us in terms of starting points? Like, are there ever agreements on starting points for democracy for you? Or can we have democracies where we have different starting points and then somehow meet mm-hmm. in the middle?
Right. So the starting point and the common point for me and for theorists who would focus more on autonomy, whether it is personal or collective autonomy in democratic societies, is that democracy is intrinsically valuable. So you can still hold that autonomy is central to democracy and have an intrinsic account of democracy. You can also have an instrumental account and say that, well, perhaps democracy will be a perfect instrument to, you know, increase my individual liberties. That is an instrumental account. But my account of democracy, the way I think about it, is that democracy is non-instrumentally valuable. And here I can agree with autonomy theorists of democracy, where yes, autonomy is the way to realize democracy is through autonomy and vice versa. By doing democracy, basically, I realize my autonomy. That is a non-instrumental argument, non-instrumental view. And I also have a non-instrumental view. I just say that by doing democracy, I realize something else, and that is political equality.
That's interesting, because one of the things that I think about is if there's an intrinsic value to democracy, then we need to agree on something that's not constructed by society itself, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like given on high that there's some value to democracy itself. Whereas I guess if we take a more instrumental account, we can maybe iron out our values and see democracy as something that allows us to achieve those values, as opposed to democracy as an intrinsic good in itself and then forcing us to justify. I mean, you thought a lot more about this, but I'm pushing back so you can kind of...
Yes, right. To me, those two thoughts are not necessarily mutually exclusive or incompatible. So I can say, as I do, that democracy for me, when I think of democracy, I try to come up with a non-instrumental account and say that, yes, it's a non-instrumentally valuable good. But I also say that democracy is required by some other value that we also independently cherish, which is social equality. And for me, social equality is even more interesting and more central in my overall work. And I argue in line with other relational theorists of democracy that social equality requires that you have equal political power. And democracy is a system that can realize this equal political power. It's an egalitarian procedure, but a distinctive egalitarian procedure, not like... a lottery that could be an egalitarian procedure, right? Or like an algorithmic model. We also want a procedure that is egalitarian but sensitive to our choices, like democracy gives us that opportunity to choose representatives or to choose policies in a way that I choose them. My moral agency is respected. It's not that I just throw dices. That would still be an egalitarian procedure. But yes, and this brings us, I guess, to the connection between democracy and social equality.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And also the intrinsic values that we're upholding and also present potentially the instrumental use cases. So is there just one final point on that? Mm-hmm. Is there an intrinsic value to democracy itself, absent the things that you want to get from democracy that you think is important?
I think so. I think yes. Because if we dig deeper, I think that democracy as a specific egalitarian procedure also best respects our moral equality, our equal moral status as moral agents who can make choices in the world, who can then be held responsible for those choices. It respects you on that deeper level, I think so. And Thomas Cristiano, for example, made that argument. It publicly respects you as equals. We always assume, I don't, you know, go that much into exploring equal moral status. I focus on equal social status. But I always assume that when I say that I want to be treated as an equal, I assume that I am a moral equal. We are all moral equals.
Nice. Yeah, I want to take a step back just to make sure that I understand everything correctly and I understand the context in which you are working. Mm-hmm. And before getting to the nitty bits, so I wanted to ask you if it's possible for you to put in terms of a question. Mm-hmm. What are you trying to answer? Mm-hmm. What are you looking at? Mm-hmm. I have the sense right now, but what are you trying to solve?
My main question is whether equal political power, instantiated through democracy, obviously, is necessary and sufficient for social equality.
Okay. So that means that you would be interested in finding out if the models of democracy that we have are enough to give rise to equal to real equality.
Mm-hmm. Not quite. I choose the model of democracy being procedural, not like a formal model of democracy where it's exhausted just by voting. Mm-hmm. I focus on democracy as a procedure. As procedure coming up with judgments and deliberating. So I guess I'm closest to deliberative democracy in that sense. But my main concern is whether equal political power will be enough to guarantee that our society is egalitarian and whether it is even necessary at all. If you have two societies, one society where you have equal political power, but not really social equality, and the other society where you think you have social equality, but where you don't have equal political power, which society would we want to go for? Mm-hmm. Which society is normatively more desirable and in line with social equality?
And in relation to this question, where are you leaning at?
I'm leaning towards saying that equal political power is definitely necessary, but by no means sufficient. It is not sufficient. We need equal consideration and concern.
So that's in the interpersonal relational relational kind of use of power.
Yes, and there we go to relational equality, exactly, or social equality, yes.
Cool. Do you guys want to go into that conversation?
Yeah, I would go through all of this this basics. I think from there I can think a little bit about that. But if you have something to shoot straight away, you should go for it.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe it would be good to clear up why you think that political equality doesn't necessitate equality in general or equity in general.
I think it's a necessary condition because, yeah, we can think of it in terms of a hypothetical example that I found in one article by Kolodny. It's called Rule Over None. Rule over none denotes this idea that no one should be ruling over anyone else. No one should be in a position of superiority over anyone else. So that is the title of the article in 2014. And here he gives an example of ascetic warriors. So this is a class of ascetic warriors that are obviously a higher class of society, and they are the rulers of that society. But then, as it happens, they are not really using or abusing their power, their privilege. So a visitor to that society would conclude immediately that those rulers and the ruled are not really acting as social unequals, that they are treating each other on an equal footing or on an equal standing. And then here, obviously, they have unequal political powers. The rulers have much higher opportunity to influence compared to the ruled. But prima facie, it seems that, you know, socially they're equal. Ascetic warriors are even ascetics. They're ascets. They are trying not to, you know, use their privileges. They're even maybe sacrificing themselves. They're maybe living worse on the whole than the ruled. So what would you conclude here? Obviously here, equal political power, political powers are unequal. So would you say that social equality here is attained? I would say not, because there was no equal political power, and because it is just contingent fact of reality right now that they are not using their privileges or powers that are due to them in virtue of their position. And Kolodny here also says, and I definitely agree with him, that you know, equal political power is necessary, because you can always point to the ascetic warriors. You can always point to the higher class or the people who could be superior to you, although they now choose not to be. In that sense, I think equal power guards us from vulnerability towards hierarchy, vulnerability from even domination and subjection, and all those objectionable social structures that we find intuitively disgusting, you know. And then we have to go into further and realize, why do we find them disgusting? What is so appalling about them?
Yeah, so one of the things that comes to mind is something that bell hooks touches on, which had rung true a long time for me, is this idea of thinking about democracy and the systems that we build through it, as opposed to something through which we might attempt to achieve equal power. There's so many struggles of power in society already which have not gotten us much good. And rather than making a positive claim about power in relation to democracy, we ought to make a negative claim about power in such that we say democracy at best allows us to not be in a negative power relationship, to not be disadvantaged in terms of power by another person. So it's not that you have equal power as others, but that you ought not have more power than others.
Right.
And that sort of creates the same level playing field, but then is, allows us to deconstruct the fact that power structures exist. We don't need to create a parallel power structure as well, and then put those things on top of each other, because that's how we get inequity more than inequality.
Right. What I would say to that is that by doing democracy, I don't think we create a separate power structure, because, as you say, power is already there. Nothing exists in a vacuum. Even if you think that you are in a power vacuum, you're probably not. But what I would say is that those there are different conceptions and types of power. There is social power, there is financial power. When I talk about democracy, I think of political power in this stricter sense. But a good thing about political power, if we want to equalize it as much as it's possible in ideal circumstances, at least, is that this political power will guard us and shield us from all these other types of power that some authors call informal powers, or powers that are not strictly in the political realm, although I always debate that because I think that everything is politics. But we can use this distinction and at least say that there is power that, at least prima facie, you will not think that it is connected to political power, but it is. So by giving everyone an equal say, respecting everyone's equal say, you will at least, as much as it's possible, protect the influences from, for example, the private sphere, the family sphere, and all these other informal influences of power, such as inequalities in wealth, inequalities in leisure time, inequalities in information, in resources, those things, you know.
Yeah, there was some things that came up to me. It's just, first of all, you consider power as the potential as well, not only the realization of it, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And and I did not quite understand when you're explaining the why. Mm-hmm. The perception that I had is just that you are accounting for the stability, mm-hmm, of the system. So you said that, well, but the soldiers do not exercise or do not abuse their power now, but they, mm-hmm, might do in the future, right, something like that. I just wanted to clarify if that's the reason why you would account for the potential, just because of certain
stability.
Yeah.
No, I'm not a stabilocrat. I'm against the status quo accounts. I would say that this is just to bring home the idea that the fact that someone doesn't use this power differential that is there formally or institutionally is just a contingent fact, and that you're still maybe vulnerable to exploitation, mm-hmm, or a possibility, as you said, the potential of exploitation and subjection.
And the other thing, just I understand, mm-hmm, the necessity of creating an isolated mm-hmm, phenomenon or thing to be studied, which is the political power itself, mm-hmm, but kind of, I don't know if concern is the right word, but I kind of tend to look, mm-hmm, at how power, different kinds of powers overlap with each other, mm-hmm, so having, for example, political power, so you have the potential to, mm-hmm, influence decisions, right, within the group. Would that be any influence of a cultural power? So, or if you are seen as an expert, mm-hmm, does your opinion, yeah, is as much valued than other people within the group? Mm-hmm. And I find it quite tricky to make the, mm-hmm, isolation of power. And because, right, I agree with you, power is everywhere and political, yeah, power is everywhere. Yeah. So if you, yeah, take any sociologist, they're going to say that it's on the language that we use, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me a little bit tricky, mm-hmm, to make the isolations,
right,
there and talk about as political power as having any kind of,
right,
privilege, mm-hmm, over other kinds of power.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. And I'm not saying that. So I totally agree with you. We are just starting here from the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. And you will see how it goes in the end. I think you will agree with me more. So political power is just a distinct concept of power. Mm. You know, as a trained analytical philosopher, I keep the concepts distinct, as you all do. But I'm not saying that it has a privileged position over other kinds of power. The exact reason why I think that political power is a necessary condition, but not sufficient, is precisely because of the overlap with these other powers. Mm-hmm. And we can be more or less radical about the extent to which we require and expect these other powers to be equalized or eliminated, if it's possible, in order to have social equality. And I primarily here think inequalities in wealth or class disparities or income inequalities, which are hard to perhaps be eliminated or completely equalized. But I tend to have a radical view on this and argue that even if you have equal political power, if you can imagine that the poor people or the proletariat has equal political power to those who are exploiting them, That will not be necessary, and that will not be sufficient for social equality, definitely. So I do agree that all of these other powers are interconnected. Yeah, we are just starting from political power, and I have to now build the argument why it's not sufficient. So this is a perfect segue for that.
Yeah. First, I want to highlight the term stabilocrat. The great term. I've never heard that term before, but I think it's fantastic. And before we dive into those, maybe just a couple of small things to iron out. Which is when we, and maybe you can not answer these directly, but then just kind of go into what you're going to elaborate on regardless. But when we have a democracy, what we're hoping is that people have equal power. And so that power ought to be something like me being able to fulfill my desires, you know, in a very simple sense. But if one of my desires is to rule over another person, then that desire ought to be excluded, right? And so then we have certain limitations on the expressions of power in that we have to limit others, curtail others' desires. So there's automatically something where a democracy must entail certain limitations, regardless of the fact that what we're saying is that people's will ought to be represented by the system itself. So that's one thing that, because you've thought a lot about it, I'd love like a good response. And the other thing is, I guess in the same sense is how do we, when we give others power via representation, how do you think about that power? And, because when we judge that power, we can think in the very sort of the old sense of tyranny, the Aristotelian sense of tyranny of if one has power over another and they are using it to benefit themselves, then that's tyranny, like in the simplest definition. Right. So how do we also avoid tyranny in that sense?
I'll start from the second one. So representation has to be justified because it poses a puzzle for political equality, for political power. By delegating your power into the hands of the representative that hopefully you have chosen for yourself out of your free will, you are giving away something that you had. But it doesn't have to follow that you are now becoming socially inferior to that person. As long as that representation can be justified morally and socially, some theorists justify it as a division of labor. Perhaps some people don't want to be representatives, don't want to deal with this. So let's choose some other people who want to do that. Let's pay them properly. Let's provide them with sufficient information so that they can make the right choices. But all the time having in mind my own preferences for those choices. So this would be a delegate model of representation. The other one is a trustee's model of representation where you entrust the person with making the decisions for yourself. But the key thing here, and I've thought about it also in my personal life, is accountability and responsiveness. So representatives have to be accountable and responsive to the represented. And there has to be an avenue, legal, definitely legitimate, for ousting those representatives if they stop being acting in line with what you want them to do and choose. So yes, if you think in terms of Hannah Pitkin's distinction and models of representation, for me personally, the most desirable one would be a substantive representation, not just descriptive, where someone would be in a place of representation that looks like me. That would also be great to see more of that also here. But even better would be a substantive model of representation where they actually do things that we chose them to do. So there are ways out of it, but definitely it's a big problem. It's a big puzzle how to justify it. But all in all, it doesn't have to follow that you are socially inferior the moment you start, you become a part of this representative line, you know, when you're on the other side of it. Yes. Also, control is another part, whether the fact that you control the representative can help out. But, you know, basically in everyday experience, we know that we cannot really control. It's a problem.
Do you think there might be some issues regarding how people perceive, instrumentalize, or avoid responsibility So in the case of delegation, for example, and I think you mentioned just very briefly that you might just don't want to make the decision. It might be costly for you.
Yes.
You might put yourself on the spotlight and just... I don't want to deal with the outcomes of
it's
it,
not especially, for everyone.
Especially because you are electing someone to represent you, which will do things that concerns everybody else, not only you.
Yes,
so there's a certain distance from you and the outcome there, which passed by the what is good for everyone else and not only me. So what do you think about responsibility? And
So you think it almost disperses with that perceived distance that you're working for the common good rather than from the people who elected you?
I think it can be seen like that, for sure.
Could be.
Yeah.
Could be, especially if you act on similarities between you and the people that you're supposed to represent, then you can also become a tokenistic representation. That is also a problem sometimes. But yes, I mean, some representatives are less or more responsible. This is more, I think, a question for psychologists. For me, I'm more interested in when, if at all, it is justified that they occupy those positions of power, which give them so many more potential privileges and immunities. And if we think of Hochfeld and rights, it gives them more power rights and immunities and claim rights, and they can change the normative situation of the people that they effectively represent. So that is a problem for moral justification.
So you look for moral justification, right?
Right, so first of all.
So that's not a... There isn't a justification not based on the instrumental or the functional role that the person has as making decisions.
For me, moral justification comes first, but it doesn't have to be incompatible with social justification. I still think that moral justification has privilege because we can socially justify many things that are not morally justifiable.
Yeah, I have to think a little bit more about moral justification. But I would think... I was thinking about legitimacy.
Exactly, that's what I'm having in mind, yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Do you want to then guide us into a bit of the argument of why you went into social equality inequality in the first place?
Yes. So, I always preferred social egalitarian or relational egalitarian. That can be used synonymously. Arguments for democracy and for justification of democracy as the authoritative procedure, as the procedure that has authority, some even say that has special authority in the sense that we have some duty to obey democracy more so, or maybe with less reservations than we would have a duty to obey maybe aristocracy or autocracy or beneficent dictators, you know, dictatorships where you have a beneficent dictator, like ascetic warriors, earlier example. And the basic outline of that argument is that social equality is valuable in itself. It's intrinsically valuable. It's something that we recognize as appealing in itself. So I'm not really going into arguing against the critics who might say that social equality is not something that we should strive for. That is an assumption. And then democracy is a necessary requirement for that social equality, and only through doing democracy you can realize social equality, and then to see the extent of this argument and to check what other values you also have to have in order to get there. But I wanted to start out with one quote that I recently stumbled upon. Let me just find it, and it's one of the critics of social equality. So the author was a French late 18th and 19th century political economist. His name is Charles Dunoyer. I did my best. And he wrote on the fate and the treatment of the French poor. He wrote on how the poor in France should be treated in the 19th century. And he said, and I quote, "It is no stranger to see men unequal in society than unequal trees in a forest. or to see men differing in fortune, knowledge, morality, than men differing in figure, size, proportions of body, faculties of soul. Minding the gendered language, of course, the point is clear. The point is that social inequality is a law of nature, and we shouldn't do anything about it because as there are unequal sizes of trees out there, this is how people are. Some are just supposed to be poor and miserable and also socially inferior, and some are supposed to be superior. So whole project of mine is against this thesis, basically.
Yeah, I mean, you get it. It seems to be a conservative argument very often of natural laws, like an appeal to something like natural laws, which, of course, is always an abuse, a misunderstanding, and outright fabrication, oftentimes, of what natural laws might be, rather than an appeal to social laws. Which the great sort of irony of it is that they appeal to something like often misuses of science, right? Mm-hmm. Like social Darwinists, exactly. Which very unfortunate that Darwin's name gets looped in with that. But also the fact that what humans have the great capacity to do is adapt, and our adaptation, our adaptability has produced the phenomenon of science. Mm-hmm. This ability for humans to think and create and recreate and abstract is, I think, best represented in the best of our social understandings, the best of our social laws that we structure and revise and reform. And they would deny all of that to appeal to some fabricated notion of natural laws, which, again, they derive from what they think is human thought and capacity for abstraction.
Right. But you have to live in a position of privilege to be able to do that, because you have to protect your own privilege. Apart from some prominent authors at the time, political economists of the 18th, 19th century, France and England, and I focus a lot on that because there is thankfully a lot written on it, and I'm just starting out in this literature, there was Francis Galton, the famous eugenicist, who claimed that the poor should not just be socially inferior or should not just remain in those positions, but should potentially be prevented from marrying, and should just basically be victims of his project of eugenics. And some of those notes are left in his utopic dystopian, or utopian for him, novel, Can't Say Where, that was recently published, although his niece attempted to hide it away. But yes, there were very weird views out there. Still are, I guess.
Yeah, and by the way, Galton is also a cousin of Darwin, was a cousin of Darwin. And that's the really wild thing is you get somebody who promotes and invents really a lot of statistical methods used for sciences. I mean, as cognitive psychologists, we owe strangely a lot to Galton. But thankfully, we never hear about him because he also wanted to erase half the population from the earth.
There is a fundamental component on social Darwinism that it's not... It's not only there is obviously the appeal to the natural fallacy, but something that is without that doesn't work with social Darwinism is the idea that there is a linear classification of those differences, right? So, so that's different than saying there are differences between individuals, or those differences are qualitatively. Or even, I don't know, quantitatively different. So there's like societies or people who are better and others that are worse. So without linearity and hierarchization of those differences, there's no, these aspects of social Darwinism are put aside. But there's a still difference between individuals, right? And that's something that I want to ask is, so does everybody's right to decide for everybody on a democracy have to have the same weight? I'm thinking about if individuals are different, for example, and if you have a minority that has, for example, a special need. So we are in a wheelchair and we need a proper ways to deal with that on this building, but there is only three of us.
Right.
With wheelchair, how much our decision power should be able to, how much our needs should influence our influence on the decision power process, because there are differences.
Yes.
And we should account for them as well.
Exactly. I agree with that. That's an interesting point. And I think in non-ideal circumstances, where you have minorities, or you have people differently abled, people differently, or historical minorities that have been victims of historical injustice, in those situations, social equality requires political inequality, in the sense that they have more push up from the society or from institutions to get to the position where they would anyways be if the society was not unjust towards them. So only in those situations, I think it would be morally as well as socially hopefully justified that there are some inequalities in power. Mm-hmm. So some inequalities in power are justified, like in these non-ideal situations, or in the situation of representation, or in the situation of affirmative measures. I think this is unequal power that is justified.
Cool.
Yes.
Yeah, we also discussed this with Angarika in the fourth episode, which she works on fairness. Yeah, because there is an important thing to acknowledge, which is that, yeah, we are different. But the question is, what are the ways in which we are different? And one of the ways we would assert, I think the three of us, in which we are not different is our difference in value, our difference in worth.
Right.
But all of the other ways, of course, are different.
Right.
And we ought to account for those differences. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the main sort of conceptual differences is that there are those who argue, like the quote you read from Galton, that the differences that exist between individuals also allow us to rank them in terms of their value. Mm-hmm. And we hold the value constant and acknowledge the differences.
Exactly.
And if we hold the values constant, then we need to build systems that can better account for differences. So this is also takes us to the question or the point that what can seem like inequality in the short term mm-hmm. is actually the truest form of equity, can be the truest form of equity in once we account for the whole of the context.
In the long term
yes.
dimension. Exactly, I agree with that. Yes. Yes, but I wanted to, since we are starting to talk about social equality, we have to define, as good philosophers, what is social equality? And I prefer to say what social equality is not. So I subscribe to those accounts of social equality that are like negatively defining social equality, just like you can negatively define freedom. There are also some accounts there out there that also can define it positively. But I think the grant of this disgust that one feels when you see social inequality or when you experience it is more captured by the negative account. So let's start with a female author, Elizabeth Anderson, in 1999 article, What is the Point of Equality? Says that egalitarians should be committed to creating a community in which people stand in relations of equality to others. Okay, pardon me, this is just a general understanding, but I wanted to start with a female author because she also calls social equality synonymously with democratic equality. She talks about democratic equality a lot, and democratic equality for her means social or relational equality. So the connection between democracy and social equality is even more pronounced in this term. Yes, let's go, for example, with another female author, Karina Furi. In 2015, she says that social equality is an opposition to status hierarchies. This is what a society of equals is. And for Kolodny, it's a rule over none. It's a rule where no one is a social superior to anyone else and no one is a social inferior to anyone else. For Schaeffler, in 2015 article, we should care about the establishment of a society of equals, a society whose members relate to one another on a footing of equality. So these are all synonyms, equal social standing, footing of equality, equal social status. This is the goal. And what we want to avoid are social hierarchies, social status inequalities, objectionable hierarchies that can potentially lead even to domination. So this is what we want to avoid. I can start with another quote. on because when you think of social inequality, you always imagine some paradigmatic cases. You have been there, but if you haven't been there, if you have been so lucky to not be a victim of social inequality, you have to think of some paradigmatic examples from the literature or from other societies. And a very common example is plebeians and patricians in Rome, or Brahmins and untouchables in the Indian caste system or Hindu caste system. And I can read a quote from Ambedkar, a famous Dalit leader and the first minister of justice in Jawaharlal Nehru's government, who was a Dalit himself, but he managed to get to a position where he will be respected finally. So now he's describing the treatment of socially inferior in a caste system in India. And those socially inferior, or the outcasts, are also called untouchables. And this is from his book, The Annihilation of Caste. So he says, "The untouchable was not allowed to use the public streets if a Hindu was coming along, lest he should pollute the Hindu by his shadow. The untouchable was required to have a black thread either on his wrist or around his neck, as a sign or a mark to prevent the Hindus from getting themselves polluted by his touch by mistake. In Pune, the capital of Peshwa, the untouchable was required to carry, strung from his waist, a broom to sweep away from behind himself the dust he trod on, lest a Hindu walking on the same dust should be polluted." This is an extreme example of social inequality in practice, and there are many examples that are troubling me from the literature and from experiences that we all have every day. And you try to figure out what is the core of this social inequality. Is it the expectations? Is it the norms? Is it the status inequality? Is it the fact that this hierarchy structures society as a whole, which is also true? Everyone can point to the norm, everyone can point to your position, judging by the way you're treated, judging by how you treat yourself, how you put yourself out there, because it's the norm to behave a certain way. So this is in the realm of conceptual analysis for now of social inequality.
Yeah, I mean, this is so much crossing into the realm of also psychology of how you could get to such an extreme form of disgust for another human being. This is how we get to Aldous Huxley's quote, "Thanks to words, we've been able to rise above the brutes, and thanks to words, we've often sunk to the level of demons." Yes. I mean, that is exactly it. I mean, mm-hmm. the creation of the concept of, in this particular case, Hindu and Dalit, but is by no means limited to that type of relationship, is so profoundly abstract, right? This idea that pollution of dust from tread on by another individual, pollution of shadow, yes, is so extreme, and in one sense is just like remarkable in a horrible sense of what human beings are capable of when you give them power which is unchecked. Mm-hmm. And in the other sense, of course, a harrowing account of why to do this type of work anyway, of appealing both to structuring systems in a way which doesn't allow for that to happen, but then also trying to better understand, like what Guilherme's focus of research is on, of how structures of power can exist in such a way to create such inequalities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would go through, that's a part of the question that I'm trying to answer, how actually social hierarchies emerge through different kinds of psychological processes, mm-hmm. or how that, if you go into your question, and I would look how I have a strong, maybe not so strong, but I have my opinion that this is a case of culture. Mm-hmm. So you learn something,
right,
throughout your life, mm-hmm. And you're not high wired to be in a caste system, basically. Yeah. So you learned, looking at hierarchical structures and other animals, mm-hmm. we have a hint of what they are there for, like naturally. Mm-hmm. Because my question is, it's basically that, like, is there a natural or any kind of human interaction that leads to that to this voluntary deference? So that's my my research question. It's on voluntary deference. And what are those other forms of social hierarchies that seem so messed up, such as caste systems? Because it doesn't seem to solve any problem. It seems to create more problems to most of the people involved on the social groups. So when I looked on what our social hierarchy is doing, they are in a specific context, so in time and space, defining some expectations between individuals, so they don't have to make the calculation of what should I do in this situation. So there is an expectation of position or relative standing between individuals, and that provides you with the most appropriate information that you need to make a decision in that specific social context in time and place. So that's what hierarchies are doing. They're providing you information that you can use to navigate social relationships. In the case of culture, that will be extrapolated. So you're going to, humans are really good in creating really crazy belief systems, right? So including dehumanizing someone else of your own species.
Yeah.
So that is included in the package of crazy beliefs that we can have. And when you learn through a society that those hierarchical structures are beneficial for you because you can predict what kind of social relationships you should have when you walk in the street and someone else is walking in the same street than you, I would be looking at how that can be perceived as solving a problem at all. So why do you need to predict someone touching someone's shadows? Like, this is not a prediction that leads you anywhere.
Yeah.
So it becomes just this make-believe word that everybody expects that to happen, but it's based on expectation, and nevertheless. So that would be my way to approach this problem. So I would be looking at social interactions and how that leads to voluntary deference. And then if I would apply to a micro-society, if I could observe a society dealing with these coordination problems, what kind of rules of thumb would emerge out of it? As crazy as they could be, as irrelevant, as most irrelevant that it could be, these rules of thumb are managing our expectations and how we should deal with other people. So I went through my research questions here, but to make the connection with what you're going for. And I am interested in the same kind of questions. But the thing with the dehumanization is part of this belief systems that we are able to come up with, and if they can justify even the most horrible things, we know very well that those belief systems do that.
Right. There is so many interesting things there to unpack. So from what I understand, you approach social hierarchies as a way out of the coordination problem that is definitely there. So we need to coordinate. We need to have some visible ways that are publicly available to everyone that will help us find our way around through a complex society, if we live in a complex society like we do. And this brings me to the point of saying and making clear this distinction with which I've been grappling for a while, and that is social hierarchy is not always objectionable. So there can be some instances of social hierarchy, like in workplace or in a school system or between parents and children, that are not objectionable because they're justified. And some other social hierarchies, more of them, are objectionable social hierarchies. I was thinking whether I should make a distinction between just status distinction, like a distinction in society that you have between the status of married people and the status of single people or unmarried people. They have different status, different institutional benefits and immunities that they can get, but you still don't have to have to say that they constitute objectionable social hierarchy. So if you're thinking of hierarchy in this non-moralized term, that it doesn't have to be necessarily objectionable, then I can agree that, of course, sometimes we need some hierarchy in this sense to figure out our complex social surroundings and our lives. Whether it is natural to sort of defer, even voluntarily, is a very interesting question. Mm-hmm. I have read it also somewhere in the literature that one relational egalitarian noted down that, well, you know, social hierarchy is everywhere in some sense or in some form or the other. It's become almost organic in our society. From going to school and having these cliques and having a social hierarchy within your peers, within these peer groups, to later in school systems, higher education, workplace environment, then later with representation, it seems that we cannot escape social hierarchy. I would at least hope that we can escape this objectionable social hierarchy, this conservative or aristocratic argument, like the one I read out before, that social hierarchies, objectionable ones, that bring with themselves some differences in esteem and differences in esteem that can lead to stigmatization and to, on the far end, to dehumanization even, or to social death, or to extreme social invisibility, that these sorts of hierarchies are definitely objectionable and are not natural and should not be regarded as natural, should be fought against. Yes, but there are so many interesting things there.
Where do you
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think that the esteem come from?
Esteem?
Yeah. So people are going to evaluate social status differently, right?
Right.
What does provide them the meaning necessary mm-hmm. to evaluate those social status differently?
So there are right reasons and there are wrong reasons for anything in philosophy. So for esteem, the right reasons would be esteeming a person based on their some characteristic that you personally appreciate or like that doesn't generalize over their whole personality. Mm-hmm. If you personally esteem someone that has a lot of money, it would be wrong to generalize that on the whole personality of that person or on the similar people to that person, to people of the similar social standing or financial standing. Then it becomes objectionable to esteem or disesteem someone just because they're rich or poor. Things like this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to think about right reasons and wrong reasons. Basically, it's when you don't overgeneralize a character. You can esteem a sportist because they are a good sportist, but not have with that also deference to them as if you are a slave or.
Do you have a hint? Do you have a hunch on the question that do you think we more often overgeneralized?
I think so, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. And we're also taught to do that, I think.
Do you think we're taught?
I think so, through culture, through socialization, and through reinforcement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in this sense, you have like the question of what taught means. But yeah, I think mm-hmm. the sort of social mimicry that we engage in from yeah. observation and social learning, we're going to be picking up things that other people do. So it takes one person with some degree of esteem to hold another in esteem. And then mm-hmm. there's sort of like a relational chain there.
I guess so.
But you have, I mean, in one sense, we need expertise, right? And expertise and whatever esteem it comes with ought to be domain specific mm-hmm. For obvious reasons, because it doesn't transfer.
Yeah.
Because we need... expertise is a pragmatic solution to complexity.
Mm-hmm.
There's a remarkable amount of complexity. We have a pragmatic solution that is certain individuals get to specialize. That specialization allows us to not worry as much about that thing.
Yeah.
There's a limited amount of time and an unbelievable amount of things to deal with. However, what we get is the potential for tyranny, in that we get a potential for an individual to then abuse the power both within the domain and extra the domain. Mm-hmm. So we always need individuals who are subject to any type of social inequality need levers to be able to check that.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes students, mm-hmm. children, right? I mean, children against parents, students against teachers, people working under management, you know. But what we often do is remove those levers, or we create power structures which then create a chain of codependent power in checking the power of one person means checking the power of the person above them. Mm-hmm. So then every layer has somebody two layers above who's trying to keep the power structure in place.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting sort of problem because on its whole, like you said, we need systems and structures where wherein equality is not necessarily achieved or desired, because it then hinders what people might get out of a system otherwise, the benefits children might get out of getting an education from not other children,
right.
But then also makes them subject to abuse.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's why it is very important to radicalize democracy and to not just think of it in terms of being applicable and applied to a political system, strictly understood, but also to a workplace. So there is a lot out there in the literature and practice, hopefully, in workplace democracy or education democracy. I'll become a research assistant if everything works out on an interesting project by Osun on how we can pin down good, desirable initiatives in education that are democratic, that are inclusive in higher education in specific. And also some people argue that children should get perhaps voting rights much earlier than they usually get in order to also avoid this dependency and vulnerability to abuse. So yes, I'm sympathetic to all those arguments. I think they're very important.
So your work has gone from focusing more on democracy and systems of governance to then you, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you then thinking, okay, well, if we focus purely on power within systems of governance, we are ignoring all the other power that society affords us.
Right.
And then looking at typically how even some of the systems of inequality are maintained by looking at those who are underserved and underprivileged.
Right. I'm thinking to what extent the equal political power can get us to social equality, how far it can get us there.
So then after following that chain, you then look back towards representation and democracy.
Not necessarily representation, but democracy, yes. Or democratic authority, yes.
Okay. So from systems of governance to the products and the structures that they are in, to then seeing systems of governance as the primary way to solve or address some of the other problems as well.
Right.
Okay. Right. That makes sense.
Yes. I'm also focusing a bit more on the debate between these two right now prominent democratic authors, democratic theorists, Niko Kolodny and Daniel Vihov, on something that they initially agree upon, which is that democracy is necessary for social equality and that we have a duty to obey democracy if we want to get to social equality. But what they disagree on, when you dig deeper a bit into their arguments, is just how necessary this equal political power is. What I mean by that is, imagine that you have this equal political power and you get to social equality. But then imagine that you could have gotten to this social equality even with some relative distances from the ideal of equal political power. Imagine that it's not possible to get there. We're living in non-ideal circumstances. Perhaps we're just building up the society or the system of governance. And so the question is, to what extent can we expect and call certain type of treatment among each other as citizens if we do not have equal political power? Because the reality of the matter is that people have different financial powers, different access to information, education, different access to capacities also to transform the information to, you know, irrelevant solutions, I guess. And so there you get into the debate of whether equal political power or political equality is just a baseline, is an egalitarian baseline or a default. And then if you can get to where you want to get, which is social equality, without this baseline, it just cancels it out. Nothing is regrettable about it. You couldn't have equal political power, but it's all good because you have social equality. That is, in simple terms, the baseline account. And then you have the account that is a bit more substantive that says, no, political equality is an ideal in its own right. It provides us with some specific reasons that come from that ideal that in the case in which they may be overridden or overweighed, you should still say, well, something is very regrettable about the fact that we couldn't have this equal political power, but perhaps for some other reasons, perhaps very much justified, we have to distance ourselves from this ideal in order to get to social equality. And Kolodny and myself and authors that I read, anti-caste authors, authors who conceive of social equality as anti-caste paradigm view, this is the name in the literature, they present their views as being as belonging to this second group, as valuing political equality in its own as an ideal, valuable in its own right. But then Vihov comes and says, well, wait a minute, if you can justify the problem of representation so easily and you say, well, it's okay that we have an equal political power because it's justified, we need division of labor, we need to divide these resources for complexity's sake, then it seems that your view is nothing but a baseline. Nothing but a baseline view, as long as it can be justified. And I've been spending some time in this debate, and my conviction is that Vihov is not as charitable to Kolodny and to authors like this. Because yes, you can justify inequalities in political power, but you can still find it regrettable that political equal political power cannot be reached. Like, yes, it would be great to have direct democracy, but it's regrettable that we cannot have it because it's impossible to have it in this level of complexity of society. And perhaps there is something even specifically valuable about representative democracy that direct democracy would not have, for example, such as the fact that if you have direct democracy and you have the majority of people wanting option A over option B, then obviously option A will prevail. But it also means that you can have a tyranny of majority if they are able to influence their opinion and perhaps overlook the opinion of the minority. In representative democracy, if you have representatives in the sense of, for example, one representative for one opinion, then this can become even perhaps more fair. Then maybe you can avoid the potential for tyranny of majority, because then you wouldn't have 100 people wanting arguing for one opinion. You would have one person arguing for one opinion. And then these 100 people or 150 will then decide what they want. They will not see the immediate, you know, proportion of popular opinions. So to go back to the debate, I argue that political equality is an ideal independent in its own right, that it's not just a baseline view, but still that there is some work to be done also in the theorists such as Kolodny who want to make this claim that, yes, we value it independently. And here I primarily disagree with Kolodny's conclusion that, you know, you can have social equality even when you have equal political power. But here is the catch. Even if that power amounts to zero and if everyone has zero political power. Now, this just brings us closer to algorithmic model or to autocracy. You know, you are throwing dice, everyone has zero influence in reality. And now we're supposed to call it equal political power. Here is where I disagree. And I propose a modified conception of political equality, which has to be equal political power, but positive, as I said earlier, positive to your choices, greater than zero, definitely. And you cannot have social equality if everyone's political power amounts to zero. We are equal in this very formal sense, but we are not equal in a substantial, substantive sense, and our moral agency is not respected. And so I'm in favor of adding more and more of these qualifications of how to create a more and more substantive view of political equality that will be sensitive to all the inequalities of power that are connected to it, but are not political power, that are financial power, class disparities, leisure inequalities and stuff like that. And I am aware that this makes my view probably very restrictive, but so be it.
Yeah, how do you... So when we have things like the tyranny of the majority, mm-hmm. When we have representation, we might get situations where the minority is actually able to rule. Mm-hmm. So how do we rebuke that? How do we justify one over the other? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we can take an instrumentalist view, just look at the greater good and say a tyranny of majority is always better than a tyranny of the minority purely mm-hmm. because more people mm-hmm. benefit.
I see.
But clearly neither is justifiable. But how do you push back against the mm-hmm. that sort of juxtaposition?
Mm-hmm. This sounds like some type of epistocracy or some tyranny of the elites.
Oh, not even. I'm thinking of the United States.
Uh-huh.
right, where you have... So right now, the Supreme Court in the United States has 9 justices on it. 6 of the 9 justices were appointed by presidents who all lost the popular vote. Mm. So here you have minority tyranny of opinion, which is the opposite in my very elitist view from an epistocracy. So you have this minority opinion, which is focused on natural law rather than social law, mm. and has imposed natural law, what their misinterpretation of what they believe to be natural law, which also kind of bleeds into divine law in the specific case, and it imposes that on the majority of people.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we build this sort of has eroded faith in democracy on both sides in cases like the United States, whereas an aspect of democracy is that we lose sometimes, mm-hmm. and I think that that's probably a good aspect of democracy.
Right. It's fair.
It's fair, and it also ensures that there is some system of check and balance.
Right.
But we, in situations where a populace gets so polarized, mm-hmm. The divisions are so stark, then losing means losing quite a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we... The point in certain places, like the United States, and I think India is getting there very rapidly, is that the beliefs that people predicate their political opinions on are radically different.
Mm-hmm.
So what they even believe equality is then different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That is an interesting question. We all have different conceptions of what equality is or what valuable goods in politics are. And it would be unfair and unjust if we would personally go out and try to impose our own conceptions of the good on another person or my own judgment over you. That's why democracy is a perfect way, and here I'm talking in line with Thomas Cristiano, that it enables that everyone has an equal say, and then whatever you choose, as long as you don't choose to disenfranchise people, or you choose something that will undermine the aim of the whole process that you are actually doing, you get to a conception of justice that is publicly available to everyone, that can also be good for coordination, and that now you have a duty to obey because you have all chosen it. In the case of the US, where obviously something is wrong with the democratic representation, but like elsewhere also, it would be ideal if there would be some other legal avenues for you to hold your representatives accountable. If they are not, if all of these avenues have been tried, but they have failed, successfully failed, then I argue and I agree here with theorists of civil disobedience that civil disobedience is the way to go.
I'm with you on that. That's a good answer.
I would expect that.
I have one more question. What about so if we have political equality, what about we have political equality, and whether it's a good in and of itself or it is being used as a means to achieve social equality,
mm-hmm.
Social equality already exists.
Mm-hmm.
So when we get political equality, we can still have certain individuals who are in the privileged position to manipulate
mm-hmm.
The system. So I don't have equality yet, and in society, mm-hmm. and the fact that I have a lack of equality means that the political equality mm-hmm. can generate even greater inequality.
Mm-hmm.
So I can, with my absorbent amount of money, we have an equal vote, I can sway others to vote in a way that disenfranchises you.
Right.
And all of a sudden, through political equality, we've gotten to a place where we have less social equality, which I think also is happening in the United States.
Yes, yes. Yes, this is the problem of formal political equality, understood as just equal votes. For me, political equality would have to be, as I said, sensitive to these extra political influences, like primarily in income and wealth. And if we cannot equalize wealth, then we can at least strive to minimize the inequalities or to go for some other policies like, I don't know, universal basic income. Of course, it's arguable and I'm not an expert on it, but... or, for example, we can constitutionally set the limits to spending in campaigns, for example. Stuff like that that can be done, should be done in order to make sure that this political equality is not just pro forma, but it actually means something. Yes, political equality is non-instrumentally valuable, but when I say that it's required by social equality, I don't say that it's just a means to get to social equality, although in a sense, yes, but it's required by it. If you don't have it, you cannot have it. But also at the same time, it's not sufficient. It's not a sufficient condition. And there we go to some other conditions. But in order to get to those other conditions, let me go back to the conceptual analysis of social inequality, basically. And there are so many lists out there in the literature of what it means to be socially unequal. What is it that you have or don't have? And I have created some amalgamation between Vyhov and Kolodny. And I think that your social status amounts to three things. The first one is your political power. The second one is your consideration, how you are considered by your fellow citizens. And the third one is concern. So consideration is basically the reactions of your citizens to you. Those can be reactions, they can be similar to expectations, normative expectations of their behavior towards you and your behavior towards them. Emotions, anger, shame, disgust, awe, pride, all of this is understood as a consideration. And then the concern is a concern of your citizens towards your independent claims to means. This is more distributive. How concerned I am towards your well-being, you as a poor person, compared to how concerned I would be for well-being for someone who is maybe rich or successful or socially admired by most of the people. So these three things, I think, constitute social status. And when we think of social inequality, when I think of it, then I think of these three dimensions. And the first one, we talked about it a lot. And then I say, okay, I focused on it. It's not sufficient because these two can sometimes really pull the weight. Because one of the reasons why democracy is so necessary for social equality for many authors is because, as I said, democracy will shield you from these other influences. It will moderate these other influences, ideally. But my worry is that if these other influences and inequalities are so huge, or even if they're not so huge, because that's a relative definition, are more concerning than maybe some authors would want them to be. They're more worrying for social equality. The fact that you have such income disparity and class disparity today and have always had, political equality is not enough. It's not enough. No matter how much you try to constitutionally introduce these limits, checks and balances, and it will always somehow carry across. And we need to think of it harder. And while thinking of it, I got interested in reading social history articles on the treatment or on consideration, to use that term, of the poor, the working poor or the unemployed poor in Victorian England and also in France from early modern period. And that literature just shows how much consideration really in itself creates a social hierarchy that is objectionable. Because a very usual argument is that inequalities in, for example, wealth can undermine social equality through political equality, because if you have more money, you can invest more resources into campaigns, you can get more people to vote for you, and then in the end, because here we don't have equal political power, if we follow the initial argument, we'll have a socially unequal society. But I also want to now focus more on how inequalities in wealth that give rise to unequal considerations and to stigmatizing differences, how they immediately and directly undermine social equality and create not just social hierarchies that are used in non-moralized sense, but that create objectionable social hierarchies. Yes, so we can go later into that a bit.
Yeah, I think...
No, that's a lot to think about, actually.
Yeah. There's a lot there also with just better understanding power, social stratification in general, deference. And then also on my end, like what the individual factors are that weigh on and shape an individual's cognition. And they make them either susceptible to certain beliefs or susceptible to certain behaviors. What types of things pressure individuals to voluntarily defer to people? What type of pressures lead individuals to not revolt against serious injustices? But if you also don't have any comments, we can also go into... you can just keep going.
Okay. And before I go into poverty, let me just clarify that the way I use social status is not as a fixed term. Social status is a flexible concept because it's a comparative notion. You always compare your social status to someone else, and you can have differences in your social status compared to who you compare yourself with. So it's a flexible term, and it's basically a social position that is visible to everyone, as I said, that everyone can point, and it's generalizable. It has a social reality. It's not like just imaginary. It has a social reality. People will know how to treat you, and you will know how to treat them.
And importantly, it's only defined through other people.
Right.
Right,
exactly. Perfect. Yes. So I went through the history of the treatment of the poor from the early Middle Ages, and it's bizarre how it has changed. And it hasn't changed in a vacuum, of course. It changed through Industrial Revolution and through the understanding and realization of how the poor can benefit the rich, and not just spiritually, as you will see was the case, but also very tangibly financially. And it's interesting how in the early Middle Ages, the poverty was always considered sacred because Christianity, if we focus on Christianity in Europe, was the religion of the poor. And there was a famous saint, Saint Francis, who became voluntarily poor, and he became this figure of poverty as a saintly and sacred thing. And in line with that understanding of religion, the poor were treated as sent from God, and it was a customary thing for the people who were more well off to provide alms, to give alms to the poor, even in public spaces, because that was the way that they would secure their space, their place in the afterlife. And there is an interesting medieval saying, God could have created all humans wealthy, but he wished there be poor people in this world so that the prosperous should be given an opportunity to redeem their sins.
Hmm. So an instrumentalist view of charity.
Exactly.
Nice.
Yes, and instrumentalization of someone's suffering and position in society for your own benefits, spiritual benefits, I guess. But then once it was realized that the poor can be a basis for wealth creation, that they can be exploitable as early as the late 17th century, then we have a distinction made by a fellow philosopher, Jeremy Bentham, who distinguished between the true poor and the false poor. So the true poor are those, I guess, that through no fault of their own became poor, air quotes, just because they were differently abled or they were just very old and they couldn't care after themselves or they got into some severe illness. And they do not deserve charity, but then they're false. They deserve charity, I'm very sorry, but false poor don't deserve charity because they're just schemers. They want to rely on charity and not work at all. I mean, the same argument is present today very much. They're basically the parasites, that would be. Yeah, I remember the Parasite movie right now. and then a new proverb was became popular that I found in this article by Vigdis Brochdu. I'm sorry if I butchered her name. She's a professor of anthropology, and she wrote that then some local church communities under poor laws in the 17th and 18th century Europe would provide charity to the poor with the following motto, which is work for those that will labor, punishment for those that will not work, and bread for those that cannot work. That was their idea of who deserves, who is the deserving poor, who is the undeserving poor. And so the perceptions of the poor were primarily of the poor as autonomous economic agents who are responsible for their own condition. And their poverty is justified because they're idle or indolent or all these other fancy synonyms for being lazy. That was the predominant discourse. Edmund Burke, for example, said that the poor were lacking patience, labor, sobriety, frugality. So the consideration and the perception of the poor was as of people who are bad managers a priori, who are lazy, who are not sober, who are drunkards, who are impatient, who do not know how to just earn decent wages through their decent work. And then we have Malthus, a famous English economist, who in the 18th century came up with a list of virtues that should be developed by the poor, assuming, of course, that they don't have these virtues and that the rich, I guess, have those virtues. And so he would say that the poor have to develop being docile, industrious, sober, prudent in domestic economy, avoiding dependency on relief at any cost, that's bad, practice restraints from unconsidered marriage and careless breeding, join a friendly society, and make deposits in a savings bank.
Careless breeding. it's a contemporary capitalist manifesto. Yeah.
Yes, that was a thing. I think in Germany at one point it was even prohibited to intermarry if you couldn't sustain a family.
Yeah, yeah. Malthusian thinking had a big impact on the United States.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, so then we have another interesting quote, Townsend. In general, it is only hunger which can spur and goad them to labor because they work too little. And Thomas Chalmers said very uncharitably in the 1832, he said, men, again, gendered the terminology, I'm sorry, men will become voluntarily poor, but they will not become voluntarily blind or deaf or maimed or lunatic. So basically touches the idea that they are basically just schemers, profiteers, and that they will not be voluntarily blind, but will be voluntarily poor. Okay, so that was the dominant discourse. You can see how they were perceived. Indolence, scheming, I said. And so before the new poor law in 1834, there was some poor relief in England, for example, that was called the Old Poor Law, whereby it was required from a village or a local town to collect finances for the poor, to sort of have a tax for the poor, and then out of these taxes they would provide poor relief. But then because of all these prevailing ideas, once they decided that the poor should come to the cities where they can work and be underpaid and exploited, then the distinction started between the true poor and the false poor, and then the public perception led to the new poor law of 1834, which led to the construction of workhouses, although workhouses existed way before this new poor law, but workhouses started confinement and exploitation for work, of the working poor now. There were also opposing views, maybe not that popular. Even Ricardo thought that there must be something in the environment that is making people poor, like in the precarious conditions and in the fact that the market prices for labor were extremely low and below its natural level, which is how the working people became even less well off and became poor. Sismondi was famous for saying that the poor are not improvident, they're actually very far-sighted, that they are thinking whether they should have families, and he advocated for a progressive tax scheme, for regulation of working hours, for pensions. And also Turgot claimed that he emphasized the point that working poor were poor because they were very dependent on wage earners and because you could not easily anticipate when your skills are going to become marketable or in demand or not in demand. And also thanks to the industrialization, when machines were starting to do some basic skills that the working class people were doing, then you would even could find yourself even easier out of labor. So this is the opposing discourse.
Yeah, just to make it relatable for folks, two things that come to mind immediately is a lot of these ideas are still held in every country in the world, basically. I know specifically in the United States, we have disability checks that you can claim if you are unable to work. So it's basically the government and society at large saying, if you are unable to work in a way which we deem that you are impoverished in a justifiable way, you are the good kind of impoverished, then we will send you money. And in the same sense, if you apply for unemployment in the United States, in order to get unemployment, you need to demonstrate that you are actively applying for jobs. Mm-hmm. So you need to show the government that that you are not lazy. And so these cases that you're outlining are enacted currently in the legal structure in the United States and many countries around the world, if not all of them.
These are just the seeds of what we see now and will continue seeing probably. From the early modern period, from the great European continent.
I believe that there is an almost objective way on which we can perceive unfairness on distribution of labor, for example. So we can do it in experiments, right? We can have someone doing a task that's much harder than the other one, and then you kind of see where their motivation to split the gains is going to fall. So, and people would most likely have a reaction against someone that put less work than them to do the same kind of thing. So I think there's an objective way to look at the fairness of the distribution of labor. And what the examples that it shows seems to me is just the belief, like it's just putting this stereotype and believing that that's the case for that specific group in the society. So it looks like that's just propaganda or culture, let's call it culture, but through some means of communicating or some means of reinforcing these stereotypes, resourcing some kind of basic intuition on fairness of distribution of labor, and then put it just within, putting it as a label to to part of society, right? So for me, it seems that there is something there already that we would be react against unfair distribution of labor. And then these things just emerge as resourcing this kind of intuition that we would have, which would be on the case of concerns, I would think. And what I was going to ask is just that it seems that nowadays there's something else, there's something different going on, right? Because I can pretty much conceive the idea that there are people there, especially, I don't know, I have my home country in mind right now, and maybe some personal experiences in talking to people, that you would still perceive someone as really hardworking. And then do like kind of very labor-y kind of job, but you would still justify their differentiated status on like they are poor because actually they work more than me. I spend my entire day sitting on the chair, mm-hmm. and then I press some buttons sometimes. Mm-hmm. But this guy who lays bricks the entire day, he does not produce as much as I do, or there is more value in what I do exactly. than what they do. They're not lazy. Mm-hmm. They're just right. unfortunate, but I don't know. I am smarter, or mm-hmm. I am more competent, or whatever. So it's not about the laziness of the person. There is something intrinsic on my mm-hmm. work, on my production, that is not intrinsic on their mm-hmm. production.
And these are also, it's also important to note that this is one step better than the, not much improved, but one step better than the innate value that people place, like what we were talking about before with the stratification of the Dalits. Because what you have is...
I said it before, those are all fairy tales.
No, I agree.
Fairy tales.
No.
For what is worth.
Yeah. Definitely. One of the interesting things is that you get one of the aspects of colorism which emerges is people were telling the narrative... like you said, that, oh, they work harder than me, they work outside, therefore they have darker skin. Mm-hmm. And this is, I just wanted to bring up that it's an important, like, among the many fairy tales is the idea that was then imposed on other people of, oh, if you are lighter skinned, then clearly you are of higher class mm-hmm. because individuals who are of higher class don't work outside. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then that just bleeds into the capitalist selling of whitening creams and you know, all this other indefensible behavior, but just how pervasive it is mm-hmm. and how it can go very quickly from a narrative of we are more intelligent or whatever it is from them mm-hmm. To also, well, we are better than them for these other qualities mm-hmm. and how it doesn't stay in one domain very often.
Right. That is a fair point. But oftentimes, and what is particularly pernicious about these fairy tales, as we call them, is that they don't remain just at the level of narratives, because then these narratives, of course, can justify certain actions, and those actions being interning and confining the poor together with other marginal and problem categories at the time to these places where they could work for free. They would basically be put into forced labor or very underpaid labor in workhouses or hôpital général or dépôt de mendicité. Okay, thank you to Guillaume who helped me with this. So once there was the perception that poverty can become a condition of prosperity, and we had one quote from William Petty, 17th century English political economist, who said, fewness of people is real poverty. This is what real poverty is. A nation wherein are 8 millions of people is more than twice as rich as the same scope of land where are but 4, I assume. Once it was realized that they should come to the cities and help propel the wheel of capitalism and of bringing financial benefits to people who could own the means of production, then this narrative was a perfect justification, social justification for these objectionable policies. And this is the era of the grand confinement. We have it very early on in the 17th century. We have some early workhouses in England. In France, we have an early general hospital, and the name is deceiving. Of course, it wasn't hospital. It was a place of confinement of the poor in the early 17th century, and then Louis XIV's decree in 1656 establishes this grand hospital in Paris. And then 1% of the population of Paris in a few years is interned there. And there are other decrees, like public humiliation of the beggars. It was not okay to see beggars on the street, but it was okay to put them to work in general hospitals. And there were several attempts at transforming these institutions of general hospital, because there were many buildings, into factories. And the economic significance of these institutions was also realized. So these institutions were both moral institutions after the narrative that it is a sin to be poor. So first, as I said earlier, the poor were seen as followers of Christ. Then they were seen as sinners and as lazy people. It went hand in hand. It would be said that laziness is the mother of all sins, is the biggest evil of the of every evil, every other evil, is the root of all the evils. And then this laziness and sin would help prepare the justification for interning the poor and other marginals. Just like before the lepers were interned, now it was the poor and other problem categories such as sex workers, children without parents, women without husbands, with children, people with mental disabilities. So you would have all of these marginals of European societies interned in these what Foucault called archipelagos of panoptical institutions. And a fun fact, Panopticon was created by Jeremy Bentham, designed. I recently found this out, too late. So yeah, workhouses were created by design from this Panopticon of Jeremy Bentham.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the individuals have always been used as cogs of war. Mm-hmm. The poor have always been seen as dispensable, which is true to this day. Mm-hmm. The military offers to do many things in order to recruit individuals. But what the Industrial Revolution allowed us to do is then see individuals as resources which then take care of themselves and are able to work. Because a lot of times when in previous systems, you had an individual who was working on your land and they were impoverished, but you also had responsibility over mm-hmm. them. What the Industrial Revolution allowed capitalists to do is use individuals, value them the same amount as the coal that they are shoveling into the furnaces, mm-hmm. and then send them home and say, well, now you have a little bit, mm-hmm. take care of yourself. And it sort of offset that mm-hmm. responsibility.
Right.
But we are getting close to running out of a bit of time. So maybe we can just turn it quickly back to things like democracy in general. One thought that I had in mind, because I think we're of the same mind on punitivism. I know that Guilherme and I at least are. I consider myself a prison abolitionist. One of the main things that we get with conviction, with individuals who have been convicted of a crime, is their disenfranchisement. So in the United States, you don't get voting rights. You are disenfranchised after becoming convicted of a crime. Mm-hmm. You are labeled convict, as though that is your status as an individual, rather than an attribute that society has given you.
Mm-hmm.
And once you have that label, I think one of the things that I think about a lot is that not only is your own right as an individual to participate in democracy removed, but also your ability to vote in a way which benefits your community mm-hmm. is removed, which then punishes the community itself, not just the individual.
Right.
But often the narrative is just that it's a punitive measure. They don't deserve mm-hmm. The right. But it is the same as, removing and I think Kolodny makes this point, removing a mother from a child to punish the mother is that the child also suffers.
Mm-hmm.
But I think even that maybe is not the best example, because there's an absolute dependency. Any individual you move from their community by laws which maybe themselves are objectionable then denies that community the right to be represented by that person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you had any comments on that.
Yeah, I agree with all that completely. It goes back to the question of whether someone is held deserving or not deserving of participating or holding some political power. Yes, I still believe that everyone has an equal moral status, and that even if you are now in a society that is a bit physically distant from the rest of the society, you're still a part of society, and you're still influencing the society, and the society still influences you. The fact that someone is in prison doesn't mean that there is no influence or no communication with the society that is outside of prison. And in that sense, it would be unfair to deprive someone of a vote, of a voting right, or any other full democratic right. Because they have to bear the consequences of what the larger society chooses, and it's unfair that they don't have an equal say in that. I was recently recommended a book on prison abolishment by Tommy Shelby, the philosopher. I still haven't read it, but yes, have you?
No.
I heard it's very good, so that will be my next one.
Yeah, there are some that we mentioned quite a lot. Angela mm-hmm. Davis is like a obviously like a personal hero, but I will put a link to another one in the show notes that I recently picked up but have not read yet by a student of hers. But we will have that there.
Yeah, I think we are running. I was going to have one more question. We just wanted to I would like to know where you stand in regard to decentralization of decision making.
Mm-hmm.
If that would be a way to go.
Yeah.
To increase both social equality and possibly equalizing political power as well. So making families having decisions regarding themselves made in together, mm-hmm. village deciding for themselves what they need within their mm-hmm. Communities, and then just expanding the scope of representation mm-hmm. of the decision as the scope of the problem increases. Mm-hmm. So if you have any thoughts on that.
I'm totally on board with that. And I think what these experiments of deliberative mini-publics have shown is that decentralization is a good thing. And if people are randomly chosen to sit and deliberate on some issues, they will deliberate and they will come up with good solutions. They will feel like their voices actually matter, and they're actually doing politics and not just having formal political equality. And then if those decisions from mini publics can then be implemented on a higher level, institutional level, I think it can just help democracy and social equality in the end on the whole.
Cool. Yeah.
And one thing I'd love to end with is why do you do what you do?
Because social equality is invaluable ideal, and because we see that right now we have less social equality than ever. There are differences in the right to grieve, also in the rights of grieving for people in context of the geopolitical situation. But even without it, I'm just amazed by the stuff that is not so not so rosy and not so nice to read and look at, because I need to read people about people's experiences from the margin, and then to normatively theorize about how society should treat people on the margin and what society should do to avoid having anyone on the margin.
For what you can find within your research, can we imagine what would be the best positive impact that you could get out of it in the real world?
In the real world.
Like, just extrapolate. Just like the mm-hmm. best kind of... the thing that would actually make you happy to get out of it.
I would like to experience and to see experienced less inequality in wealth, less class disparity, and more social justice. More social justice will just help us get to social equality.
Cool.
Yeah, right on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.